Hello, and welcome to Arado Podcast. AI-powered language services have become more and more part of our daily lives in the past decade. Where in the beginning of 2010s, Google Translate was still just a joke, today it can be easily used to read articles in other languages. Chatbots are becoming more and more prevalent in customer service, and now Microsoft Teams is starting to test out live captioning in remote meetings that works. Well, let's just see how it works in 10 years. The field is dominated by giants such as Google, Microsoft, and Amazon, simply because they are able to provide their services for free. However, we also have companies such as Lingsoft, who are endlessly searching for niches and pockets of business where the hand of such giants is not able to reach. And they are succeeding. Lingsoft has been providing services around NLP and translation services for over 30 years, and they are able to continue by finding business cases where the solutions require cooperation between linguistic experts and technology. So thank you for joining us to hear this discussion between me, one of Arado's founders, Mika Wilberg, and Lingsoft's business director, Mikael Stormbom. The discussion was held remotely, and unfortunately, this led to some issues with the audio, but thankfully these are few. Lingsoft has been our client for some time now, and Mika is working as a product owner for one of their services. For more information on Lingsoft, head over to lingsoft.fi or reach out to Mikael directly in LinkedIn. And now to the interview. Welcome to the Arado Podcast, everybody. Today we have Mikael Stormbom as our guest from Lingsoft. And with me, Mika is also interviewing him. Welcome to the podcast, Mikael.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, pleasure to have you. Lingsoft is one of our customers, and we'll be talking about sort of the company in general, the technologies you use, NLP, for example, and then also digital accessibility. But yeah, let's start from the from your background, Mikael. You have over 15 years at Lingsoft. What is sort of your background, and when did you start the company, and what has it been like?
I started in Lingsoft. It's going to be 15 years now next February. It's actually when I started in the university, Åbo Akademi University here in Turku. So then I started doing my master's thesis for another company called ImageTalk. I studied software engineering. So in ImageTalk, doing coding of Symbian mobile phones. It was the Nokia 7710, if you remember the communicator. This was so far back in time that we weren't even talking about apps yet. They were just mobile applications. So it was right before the iPhone and so forth. So I was coding then accessibility applications, as a matter of fact. So applications that facilitates, in particular for people with various types of cognitive and communicative disabilities. And while I was doing that, I was doing my master's thesis. And well, Lingsoft acquired that company then in February 2006. And I've been in Lingsoft ever since, doing a variety of things. So programming and then also project management. And nowadays I'm part of the of Lingsoft's executive team and focus primarily on business development activities and sales, in particularly in Sweden and in Scandinavia, but to some extent also here in Finland.
Oh, interesting. What you sort of mentioned that you already worked with accessibility in those old Nokia communicators. What did it mean in practice back then? What did accessibility mean then?
Yes, it was a very particular type of accessibility, this sort of like communicative accessibility. It was a sort of like an app that allowed you to sort of communicate with images in a way. So basically in the application, there was a large number of images and you could select these images to sort of create a message. And then there was also speech synthesis attached. So through that, you could create like simple sentences. For example, I want to go to the store, or I want to do this, or I want to do that kind of thing. And then the application also then could send sort of SMS messages and also parse the incoming SMS messages into. So looking at the phrases and the words and trying to find the symbols that matched this the message.
Yeah, interesting that they already in those sort of in the pretty early days of communicators and mobile phones, they already started taking in this accessibility into account.
Yeah, I mean well, I would say programming Symbian was a quite a frustrating experience, but
it was probably a little bit before its time, I would say, right? So it was quite early phases of mobile applications and having such a application that demands so much was definitely a challenge, I believe.
Yes, indeed. And there was all this sort of like fun stuff when you were dealing. It wasn't just C++, but then you had these sort of like very strange things like double constructors and whatnot. So you had to initiate everything twice and all that sort of definitely quite a different world nowadays, programming for mobile phones, because it was certainly definitely more frustrating than it needed to be, for sure. And of course, then back then there wasn't really these sort of like app ecosystems and app stores and the likes. Also, distributing the application was another chapter as well. So typically we would have to like distribute the communicator with the app to the sort of like the person who would.
It's more or less pre-installed every time.
Pre-installed.
Like, so you need to convince the, for example, Nokia to have your application in their.
No, I mean it went like that. That we installed the app, and the app had these sort of like sort of access features in that, so that you couldn't necessarily exit the app, right? Because it wasn't necessarily the case that if a person, they wouldn't necessarily be able to find their way back into the application, right? So it also functioned in a way as a sort of like a simplified user interface for the communicator. So there was all these sort of things that you couldn't exit the app, and it would launch when you started up the communicator and those sort of things. So, kind of a frustrating experience to program it, but of course for the people who needed the application, it was very sort of like essential. So in that sense, a very, very, very rewarding thing to program, to be sure. Yeah, I mean, it was a nice feeling when something you do is actually really needed.
Yeah, I bet that it sure helps the everyday life.
Absolutely, absolutely. But my theory is that that Symbian, that was the undoing of Nokia in the end, because it was just such a frustrating experience to get anything onto that onto that device.
Yeah, I have heard similar stories from and theories from other people. What about Linksoft then? Linksoft has done translation services and development around that for many years now. For example, Linksoft was the company originally creating the original translator for MS Word, right?
Yes,
like spell checking.
Spell checking and grammar. Yes, we've been doing those for the Nordic languages and then a number of other languages. I was myself involved in those for quite a while. Go ahead.
Yeah, how do you see, what are the strong points of Linksoft today, and how do you see what are like the main offerings of the company?
So our main offering is definitely our language services. So you mentioned translations, but also subtitling, transcription. We do terminology work and that sort of thing. And so it's kind of our main business is sort of combining human work with automated software, so NLP, but also sort of like the process infrastructure around it. So that's really our main line of business, that we are able to produce high quality and highly cost efficient services with human beings in the loop. So that's kind of our main line of business.
What about this technology Linksoft are fighting against giants like Google and Microsoft and Amazon when it comes to the speech recognition and maybe automated machine translation APIs and so forth? What is your niche and your advantages against these giants?
Yeah, indeed, it's a question that we get a lot. That how do you compete against Google? And well, the short answer is that we don't. We look for niches and sort of areas where we can add something to the sort of like the vanilla speech recognition that Google provides, for example. So building services around speech recognition, building services on top of speech recognition, finding specific language domains. We have an ability, for example, to customize speech solutions for very specific use cases and specific language domains. There's of course the privacy aspect that we are able to handle. That we are based in Finland. We're able to do local installations and that kind of thing. We have no particular desire to compete with Google. Really, we're looking for our own markets too.
So is it safe to say that one niche for you is basically the languages up here in North, and Google cannot really compete with those yet, at least? For example, Finnish language is quite not that well spoken worldwide. So maybe that's a niche that you can focus on. And maybe that same goes for Norwegian and Swedish and so forth.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, we primarily work with the Nordic language, and the possibility to customize really comes into it. So it's not necessarily the case that a general speech recognizer is appropriate for all types of use cases. You might have, for example, in the medical domain, you would need, there's specific vocabulary and terminology that you want to be able to support and the like. So the ability to customize for very specific use cases, I think that's where our strength really comes. Mm-hmm. Comes in.
What roles plays security here? Like if we think about giants, they very easily want to keep the data that they receive. And that might not be always that nice feature for customers and from their perspective because they are sending sensitive data to the services.
Yeah, no, indeed. So, and certainly they wouldn't be too keen to send it, their data to the giants and end up in a server overseas somewhere. But I mean, we're entirely based in Finland and we have everything locally hosted. And so that's one thing. So nothing leaves the European Union. And of course we're compliant with the GDPR regulations. And in addition to that, of course, we have the possibility to provide on-premise solutions for those customers where sort of going into the external cloud isn't necessarily an option.
You mentioned that your primary services are in a way combined services done by experts, linguistic experts, and maybe then you are using also this technology that you have developed to help that. How easy is to combine that one, and is it really complicated processes and workflows inside the company, or how would you say and describe that?
It's a good question. It can be a pretty sort of complicated affair, to be sure. And I mean, certainly you want to keep the, for example, language technology and the underlying models up to date. I mean, language changes constantly, and you need to sort of keep the models apace with that. Not to mention, for example, incorporating feedback from those who are from the human beings in the service. Like, how would they need to be developed further? So there are certainly those considerations. Then certainly the workflows can be rather complicated. So there's also a lot of these sort of like development around using the language technology that needs to be taken into account and where considerable efforts need to be put. It's not just about having language technology, but sort of how do you actually make use of it and how do you make in an optimal fashion.
Are there some use cases that you could mention in practice where this whole thing would have been put together? You already mentioned sort of the medical field. Are there some other fields where this is used as well?
Yeah, so for example, in subtitling, we make extensive use of speech recognition to provide our services. So it's a combination of a human subtitler, but they then receive this sort of like raw version of the subtitles that has been produced by, first of all, our speech recognizer. There's a number of other languages involved in this, so it's not just a question of producing sort of raw text from audio, but of course there's the timing aspect, which is important. There are a number of post-processing steps involved, for example, removing repetitions or, for example, well, stuttering and sort of hesitation in what the person is saying. Then there are different customers may have different sort of like conventions when it comes to, for example, do you want to have two rows or one rows of subtitles? Where should it be split into rows and into separate subtitles and so forth? So there are a number of sort of post-processing steps involved in that. So not just speech recognition, but a number of other different language technologies to produce the sort of like the raw version, and then there's a human subtitler who does the sort of like produce the final high quality version of the thing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That sort of how complicated it can actually be making subtitles once you sort of really start to focus on it.
Yeah, I mean, indeed, it's certainly a discipline in its own right, subtitling, and an important one. It's a very sort of essential accessibility aspect to provide that sort of multimodality, so audio and text.
Yeah, I think this segues really nicely into our second topic of digital accessibility. We have just sort of, there came new EU directives regarding digital accessibility not too long time ago. Can you explain a bit what these directives are and who do they consider and what do they mean in practice?
Yeah, so the Web Accessibility Directive, it's now been coming into force in different stages, and a most recent date was this September 23rd this year when a number of actors were sort of covered by this Web Accessibility Directive, and so it's an EU-wide directive, and it then applies in particular to public sector bodies of different kinds. In Finland, you would have, for example, municipalities, ministries, universities, and really a number of actors who provide different types of sort of public administration and public services. And it's a web accessibility directive, so ensuring that your digital services are accessible, which means a number of different things. So, for example, ensuring that the pages are structured in such a manner that it can be accessible by screen readers, which means a number of different things in the HTML, so to speak, having your tags right, having your IMG, having alt tags and so forth, but also in sort of like how the pages are structured, sort of like semantically, and that kind of things. As it pertains to audio and video, the directive states that if you publish a video or audio that is online for more than 14 days, you need to provide your sort of like text equivalent of the thing. And in practice, for example, subtitles, it can be something else as well, just for example, raw text, but subtitles would be one way to fulfill that requirement. So in practice, if you have a video that's online for more than 14 days, then you need to provide sort of subtitles for it or other text equivalent.
How would you say that this has been now applied by public sector? Are they buying these kind of services now, and they need to now, in a way, for example, let's think about Yle in Finland. If they produce a video and they put that online, basically this probably means that it has to be subtitled.
Well, Yle as a public broadcaster is not covered by this particular directive.
Okay.
But for example, if you have, for example, Turku City, when they have their municipal council meetings and they put them online, then that within 14 days, when the subtitles need to be provided. So yes, we definitely had a lot of demand for it now during the fall. I think it varies quite a bit from organization to organization how well they're covering this at the moment. But we've certainly seen a pretty massive uptick in demand there.
Hmm. What is Linksoft's role in this? You have taken initiative to help in providing these services. So what do you do?
Yeah, indeed. So we do subtitling, and in particular then. So yeah, we have Yle as a subtitling customer as well. It's a slightly different thing, but then also from the web accessibility standpoint, we provide these sort of subtitling services to customers in the public sector.
So as we discussed earlier, you have developed own technology for subtitling and speech recognition and so forth, and you have APIs available for those ones, and you use them internally when you produce high quality services in that area. What are these APIs exactly that Linksoft is at the moment offering to the market?
Yeah, so we have a number of different ones of speech recognition. We have, of course, in conjunction with that, we have something called diarization. So that's a separate API, and that essentially means being able to differentiate between different speakers in the audio stream. We also have a number of text ones, so for example, machine translation, and also text analysis more generally. So if we go really on the sort of like the deeper linguistic analysis side of it, so for example, things like part of speech tagging and lemmatization and that kind of thing. And then also for our spell checking and grammar tools, we have APIs as well. So practically all of our technologies we have APIs for, so everything is behind an API.
Okay. So if we look at, for example, a bit for other solutions that could benefit from this kind of services, let's take, for example, chatbots, which are at the moment becoming more and more popular because they can serve a large number of customers with basic information needs automatically. I think most of us has met chatbots somewhere in digital services. Oh, is technology ready, this kind of technology, for example, if we want to voice control those chatbots? And what other APIs Linksoft is offering could be used there?
I think the first question is what is really the use case of the chatbot, because of course, of certainly voice commands, and then on the other side of it, sort of producing speech, namely speech synthesis. So you would have this like voice interface. I mean, that can certainly be done, but of course, it really depends on the scope of the chatbot. I would say that if you have a more sort of limited amount of things that the chatbot is supposed to do, I think that probably works better than if it's a more open-ended thing, right? So I think it really depends on the use case.
Yeah, sort of the term chatbot is pretty interesting at the moment, because it can be anything from a simple decision tree into a thing that actually starts to understand what is being discussed about and can help with that.
Yeah, indeed, and I mean there's certainly like very important accessibility aspects there as well. So I mean certainly chatbots and these virtual assistants, they will increase in popularity now over in the coming years. That's that trend is pretty clear. So of course the ability to have like a sort of audio interface, I mean that would make it more multimodal and would certainly sort of make it more accessible. Ironically, you can also make it less accessible if you buy with an audio interface. I mean, for example, if your speech recognizer doesn't work very well with for different types of speech impediments and the like, you can and put too much emphasis on the speech aspect there, you might end up producing a solution that's or a service that's less accessible. So I think there are all these accessibility aspects that need to be taken into account
therein
as well.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting that you sort of like, I guess most of the time, if you have, for example, speech as a part of the product or speech recognition, you should also include text in that as well, that there's at least some kind of way to also access it via text, so it makes it more accessible.
Yeah, I mean, I think multimodality is an important aspect there, that you have many different ways of accessing, so through different media, with different tools, and so to make it as accessible to as wide an audience as possible, really.
Mm. It's also interesting that you said that you at least yourself believe that different kinds of personal assistants will become more popular in the near future. Is this Is this a trend that you've been following yourself? Is there something really interesting you find it there?
Well, I mean, no, that's what the what's the market analyst tells us. I don't know if I have any particular insight there, but I mean, it's already a multi-billion dollar industry, this whole chatbots and virtual assistants, and they expect it to grow quite significantly over the coming years. So I have no reason to doubt that trend for sure. Mm. And of course, if you, I would say probably the best use case for a chatbot is are those are more routine questions, right? Sort of the more predictable ones that the sort of like the frequently asked questions, so to speak, more so than a wholesale replacement of customer services personnel, but rather allowing them to focus on the more on more specific cases and more specialized cases.
Mm, yeah, exactly. There's a certain layer that can be automatized and actually can even make the service better by making it automatized. But then there's always the part of it that simply cannot be reached.
No, indeed. And I mean, I for example, I use Telia's when they have this sort of support. I like that one in that it's not this sort of like open-ended. They ask you a question, you have to write something, and then inevitably it doesn't understand what you want. But rather it gives you the options, like these are the things that I understand, and then you just click the option that is closest. I think I do feel that approach works better. I think that's also from a, if you look think of it from a user experience standpoint, that and the user interface usability standpoint. So rather you don't want to make your user guess what sort of like are the functionalities that your service supports, but rather you display them to the user. So I think from a usability standpoint, I do think that approach is better than this sort of like open-ended questions, I would say.
Yeah, and I guess it requires a lot more development work to make the open-ended test work in practice.
Yeah, no, indeed. I mean, it can work, of course, in specific cases, but of course, the more open-ended and the more broader the scope, I think the more difficult it becomes to really make it work well.
Many of these giants provide these APIs for free. So basically, you can just create an account and start using them at least for a limited amount of data. But how would you say, Mikael, if you want to pay for that service, can you expect a much better quality and results compared to these free services, or what is the difference? Why people are also paying for them?
Well, I think that again depends a little bit on the use case you have there. So, I mean, I think, for example, if I want to just look up some text in some foreign language and just want to understand the gist of it, then just pasting it into Google Translate and reading it there, that's probably fine. But if you do need to have a more accurate translation, let's say that you're localizing documentation or the like, then that just won't be sufficient, right? I mean, there are a number of things that need to be taken into consideration. They're not just like the grammatical aspects, but also is the terminology translated correctly? Are you following? Is it in the same style? Is it sort of like by your style conventions and those sorts of things? So I would say it really depends on the use case, whether it's sort of like the free quote unquote versions. If they're suitable for use case, then by all means use them, I would say. But
and it's probably also about the volumes, that how much you need to use. So if your needs are really high, then you need stability, and you need to have the service there which can serve you all the time and so forth. So
there's that as well, and of course the customization aspect. I think that's an important one to highlight as well.
When it comes to audio and even video is normally probably used for subtitling. So how high are the demands, resource demands for such services in the background? Are they big ones, or I mean, the user doesn't see that at all? What's happening behind the API when you do that?
Depends on what you think of as high, I would say.
Mm. Okay. Yeah.
Is it so much that if any company can pretty much pretty much be able to deploy it, or will it might it require some additional investments if you would need to deploy such as?
I think you need to have pretty decent hardware to be sure to run it. I mean, you're not gonna get it working on the Raspberry Pi, that's for sure.
I'm just thinking about this, let's say like a video broker, it easily are many gigabytes when you just have that file and moving that around around the services might be a challenge sometimes, I would guess. So that's what I meant.
Yeah, no. that's definitely true. I mean, just the sheer amount of time spent on simple file transfer from place to another, that can certainly be a challenge to some extent.
Hey, we talk about quite a lot about the accessibility and web pages and so forth. What is your opinion? What should the ordinary web developer today know about these things when they or he or she develops web applications? What should they know about the accessibility and all these possibilities that we have discussed today?
If, as it pertains to, for example, using NLP solutions, I mean, it has to start with what the use case is. So, for example, if it's a sort of like a chatbot interface and providing multimodality using speech technology, so I think really outlining what the use case is always a good starting point. But I think the other critical thing is to test with actual users. I think that is a key thing. I mean, there are a number of different online tools and automated tools for testing whether your web page is sort of compliant with, for example, with the what's in the WCAG, the Web Accessibility Content Guidelines, and that sort of thing. But ultimately, you have to test with users to ensure that it's actually accessible. There's only so much automated tools can tell you about a thing. So I think that is critical. Then, of course, NLP is not a silver bullet, right? As I noted, for example, there can be accessibility challenges with using speech recognition as well. So there are, I think, there are a number of different things that one needs to take into account. But I think the important one is really to test with users if you've developed a solution. I think that's the key one.
Always be keen to take people to actually test it and have the feedback on based on real life.
Yes, absolutely.
So in general, then looking at sort of NLP and perhaps AI in a broader sense, those technologies, is there something that you are yourself particularly interested in? Is there some developments that you have been excited about lately?
I think things happen so fast within the AI field that it's practically a full-time job just to keep track of what's happening. But there's certainly a lot of interesting things happening there all the time. But I think there are a number of these sort of like large-scale models that are sort of available for people to download and make use of. So, for example, there are these BERT models and so forth. And I think the interesting thing is this, where what is called transfer learning, where you can sort of use a, if you don't necessarily have a lot of training data at your disposal, you can make use of these existing models and then just train with a more limited amount of training data. So I think that is an interesting.
How would you comment the real-time use of these services, which is a little bit challenging always, that you get immediately responses and can use that in a way online directly, for example, speech recognition or machine translation or so forth, even have a subtitling which translates to another language, things like that, use cases like that. How would you comment that? Where do we stand today with those?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we are very interested in Linksoft and are developing all the time as well from that perspective. And I think, you can certainly use it to some extent, but if the requirement is that it's that the quality is very good, then I wouldn't necessarily start deploying it right now. I think there's quite a lot of work to be done there. I mean, thinking from a real-time perspective, if you're just getting the timing working with a video stream, for example, is a challenging thing. So I think certainly quite a lot of stuff needs to be done there still, but I would think it's something that's definitely on the horizon.
Would you say when we speak about language, there is always this area of dialects and like you said earlier, domains where the language is specific. For example, medicine was mentioned and so forth. What is happening there? Can I speak my dialect soon with this automated speech recognition tools, or where do we stand at the moment?
Depends on how esoteric your dialect is, I suppose. But there's actually this initiative going on that Yle here in Finland is running to sort of like collect people's speech, so in order to from all over Finland and with different dialects, so really to have this sort of like training data with different dialects. So it will be really interesting to see what the outcome of that is. But the idea is really to have this sort of like training data and material from different dialects and from different types of speech and so forth. So I think that one will be very interesting to see how it develops.
Yeah, and it seems really cool that these sort of this training data is made more and more public these days, or sort of shareable, that people can use each other's training data. So it actually strengthens the whole ecosystem in a way.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think that's a very positive development, to be sure. And I think Yle has published quite a lot of these things where you can just download and use, for example, word embeddings they have and so forth. So it certainly is beneficial to everyone that this is as widely available as possible.
Yeah. From someone who works with the technology every day and who sort of is inside the development, does it seem like you might be able to automate yourself out of existence in the future, or will it always require the human in the loop? What is your perspective?
Well, that would be my goal in life, to automate everything I do, and then I can sit at home on the couch and play video games. I would say, I mean, any type of innovation really will of course be disruptive in some manner or the other. But I don't think that we'll in that sense be automating ourselves out of existence. I mean, there's certainly a lot of manual work that goes into creating these technologies and maintaining these technologies. So just from that aspect alone, I don't see necessarily that everything will be, there will be in a fully automated future necessarily, but.
So as long as you yourself know about AI and machine learning, you will yourself have a lot of job to do at least.
Yes, and knowing a little bit of Python helps as well, but yes.
Ah, true. What is, you sort of mentioned that it's even hard for you to keep up with all the latest developments and the pace of development at the moment. What channels do you yourself follow? Can you recommend some places where you kind of get your latest news?
Well, I mean, you can always look up on LinkedIn there. For example, you can follow Andrew Ng, the professor in Stanford, is it? Deep in the deep learning community.
What about Europe in this area? We spoke about Amazon and Google and Microsoft. Obviously, they are coming from United States, and they are in a way taking over the market to some extent. What is the role of Europe, for example? Here are many languages, and we don't seem to see any big player at the moment here. Why? And is it coming?
No, indeed. I mean, it's definitely a much more fragmented market. So there isn't really a European Google. There are a number of smaller vendors like Linksoft, for example. So maybe there is this initiative around this for like the European Digital single market that will facilitate this sort of like cross-border cooperation and cross-border markets. So we'll see how that impacts really. And there are a number of these initiatives and projects around this, sort of like creating a sort of like a European ecosystem. There's, for example, this European Language Grid project where Linksoft is participating as well. But we'll just have to see how it develops in the future.
Yeah, and there should at least be a lot of work to be done, since, well, Americans have the advantage that everybody pretty much speaks English, and they have a sort of unified language front over there. It's going to be a much tougher problem to solve here in Europe.
No, certainly. I mean, the United States and China is much farther ahead than us here in Europe at the moment.
Yeah, was there some topic you would have wanted to yourself touch before we stop?
I think this was a pretty comprehensive discussion.
I actually had prepared a sort of a bonus question in the end here before we begin. You mentioned on your LinkedIn page that you do gaming and music for Stubberg.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah. Are you comfortable discussing about?
Yes, by all means. By all means, yes.
Nice. So you mentioned on your LinkedIn page that you do music and gaming on your own as a side project with the name of Stoberok. How do you see this complementing your work at Linksoft in some way, or is this more like a way for you to relax and tune out?
Well, it's a sort of like combining business with pleasure in a way. I like it. It's a creative outlet to be sure. So producing my own games and producing music. So there's certainly that. And but I have Stroberok as a sort of like a commercial entity for my intellectual property, so to speak. So if I want to do something commercial with it, then I have that sort of entity to work through. But there are a number of, for example, user experience and player experience things that come into there. Of course, well, that's the fundamental aspect of the game, really, is the player experience, right? So there's certainly that aspect, and then of course it allows me to explore different like technologies and how that can be incorporated in gaming, for example. So in that sense, I would say complementary, but it's business and pleasure, let's put it like that.
Yeah, and I guess it's sort of like you need to do similar work, that you have to kind of put yourself into the shoes of the user or the player in this case, and sort of think how it would be the most pleasurable for them to use. So sort of
no, indeed. And of course with gaming, I mean it's very much a creative outlet, designing games, but also there's sort of, and I try to do everything on myself on the games, which is maybe not the best approach, because they tend to be quite laborious in that sense, but it's sort of interesting, fun, and exciting to like work it on from every different aspect of it, from the sort of like the initial design to graphics to music and coding the thing.
Yeah, it must be a lot of fun as well.
It's fun and sometimes frustrating getting it to work the way you want, but
yeah, I bet. If people wish to find you, do you have a Twitter account, or is LinkedIn the best channel for that?
You can find me on LinkedIn, yes. That's probably the best place to find me. I am on Twitter, but not very frequently, so okay. Look me up on LinkedIn.
Yeah, great. Did you, Mika, have something you wanted to go through before we quit?
No, we want to thank you, Mikael, for joining this podcast. It was a pleasure to discuss with you.
Yeah. Thank you. It was great to be here with you today.
Thank you for listening to the episode. As usual, all feedback is more than welcome, and you can send it to hello@arado.fi. If you wish to know more about us as a company, arado.fi is the website to head over to. We are at the moment redoing most of the pages there, so you might find something new even if you have already visited the pages in the past. If you wish to be a guest in the podcast in 2021, we are more than happy to have you. Reach out and let's schedule an interview. Cheers, and happy beginning of the year 2021.